Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This week on the Mike Wise Show, we continue our celebration and analysis of The Last Dance. Episodes 9 and 10 are now in the books. Here's a spoiler. The Bulls won! We're going to go inside the Bulls dynasty with a Hall of Fame journalist who has been there every step of the way. But first, as you know, Darlene, do your thing!
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Exactamundo, Darlene! As usual. Hey, The Last Dance has been our obsession since its debut on April 19th, with the pandemic paralyzing society and the search for a vaccine in overdrive. Our sports star public was in need of a major basketball transfusion, and that's just what The Last Dance has provided. Sam Smith is standing by, and we'll get to him in a moment. But first, Bruce, what'd you think? 9 and 10.
It's been my obsession for the last 5 Sundays, and it did not disappoint. I mean, Jason Hare and that entire crew, bravo. I mean, you know, get the Emmy speech ready.
Yeah, I think so, and also. I have to give it up for Esty Portnoy, who was Michael Jordan's PR person for life, and Curtis Polk, who was with David Falk in the early days. He's sort of now, I think he's a big CEO of the Charlotte Hornets. These people convinced Michael to do this and trusted others to let people show his authentic self, the good, the bad, the ugly. And what we got was the real Michael Jordan. And I mean, in all aspects, you know, I didn't want to say I didn't like Michael Jordan, but I just didn't know him. Even when I covered him, I didn't know him. I knew he was a guy's guy. I'm sure his father's murder would throw anyone for a loop in their life. But for the most part, Michael Jordan had lived a charmed life. And here this guy is, who essentially befriends a Bulls security guard. And that guy becomes his father figure after James Jordan dies. And you know, that anecdote, just a small anecdote, but Michael Jordan calling that guy up at 2 a.m. crying, a Bulls security guard. I'm just thinking to myself, like, that, you know, the humanistic part of it, the Steve Kerr, Malcolm Kerr's father being assassinated when he was the head of the American University in Beirut, Steve being an 18-year-old at the time in Arizona, his life changing dramatically. And yet here's Steve Kerr, like, honoring his father's legacy, not just in basketball, but the guy he's become, like, trying to make other people understand that we all live in this world together. And so, I get sucked into the human drama part of it more than I do the basketball, because I know the basketball. That's what that for me was what this was about, was Michael Jordan. I saw parts of him that I hadn't seen really since the Kobe Bryant funeral, where he got teary eyed. This was not managed, packaged, homogenized Michael Jordan. This was not the Hanes underwear salesman or the guy that was dunking on Bugs Bunny. This was Michael Jordan unplugged. And I like that. I like that a lot.
I agree. I mean, it really, you know, it lived up to its, you know, hype, I guess you could say. But right. I found, you know, you mentioned Steve Kerr. For me, so much of what we saw in the final 2 episodes was Steve Kerr related, because Steve Kerr, you know, as was documented, he was, you know, left fatherless when his dad was assassinated by terrorists when he was 18. And I mean, when he would go play game, he was at Arizona. When he would play games at Arizona State, the fans, the Sun Devils fans used to, like, you know, shout like insults at him. I'm not positive, but I believe
that. Yeah. Oh, I saw that somewhere. I saw that somewhere where it was the most unfeeling, awful thing you could possibly say to someone who lost their father. And, right. And it just goes, I mean, I'm sure it was just a couple knuckleheads, but it was, you know, the fact that it happened, it's so wrong. And so, you know, so many, you know, but at any rate, Steve Kerr, guy who doesn't get recruited out of high school, essentially finally gets a scholarship at the end at Arizona and becomes a star and becomes an NBA role player and becomes one of Michael Jordan's most trusted teammates. He was a metaphor for every role player that was ever on that team and all those teams. And yeah, no, I ate that stuff up like crazy. I also, you know, like little things, I didn't know that, or I forgot that Phil Jackson was offered to coach the Bulls after the sixth championship, after everything Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf had said. Of course, I think he was going to coach a lottery team. He was going to coach a rebuild because, and that's another thing. Anybody that, you know, Michael Jordan argued that these guys would all, he would get them, you know, and sit them down and say, we could go for seven. That's nice to say. There is no way in hell that the guys on that team that had built up their value and were going to sign for deals that some of them should have never got, but they needed to make some money. They weren't going to go play for the minimum just so Michael Jordan, all those guys. I'm sorry. They weren't going to sign a one-year deal. They were going to get financial security at the end of some of their careers, like Scottie Pippen and others, and they did. And I have no problem with that. I still don't buy the argument that Michael Jordan was going to get more than three or four players to come back and play with him again.
Well, you know, and in Phil's particular case, I mean, look, he was told before the season was even underway, this would be his last season. Don't you think that his agent had already had some sort of preliminary talks with the Lakers, who were the next great franchise up and coming with Shaq and Kobe? I mean, he probably knew that that job could have been his for the taking. So it was probably very easy for him to say, you know what, Jerry, thanks, no thanks. I think I'll go win five more chips in Los Angeles.
Right, right. Well, I remember I wrote a story in '99, just a year later, that I found out that Phil Jackson had met with Dave Chekets, then the president of Madison Square Garden, and while Jeff Van Gundy was still the coach of the Knicks. And that was like, it was a huge story in New York, and the whole Van Gundy went from the little manipulator that got rid of Ernie Grunfeld in some power struggle to the whole Garden was, when that story came out, they were about to sweep the Atlanta Hawks in the second round and go to the Eastern Conference Finals. And they went to the finals that year, which is still incredible.
Jeff Van Gundy.
Yep. The whole thing.
Jeff Van Gundy.
And the whole Madison Square Garden at the end of that series sweep. And Jeff looked at me on press row and me and Isola. And all of a sudden, he's about to break down and cry while those chants are going on. And he grabs his Diet Coke on the side and he just takes a long sip so he doesn't bawl in front of everybody. It was great. It was great. So at any rate, whatever. There were tons of things in here. I forgot about Dennis Rodman and the Hulk Hogan, little
hiatus
soiree.
Hiatus part two.
Hiatus part two. I mean, the fact that you could do that in the NBA finals too, like crazy, right? And nobody knew where he was. And, part of me thinks that Phil did know. And he's just like, all right, I'm going to act like I didn't know. I got to act like I'm the coach. Damn it. Just go do your thing, Dennis. How many organizations would – it's funny. I remember Fran Blindberry. I remember I'm going to get into this with Sam Smith, but how we were convinced Rodman was going to miss those free throws at the end because it's karma, it's basketball, it's life. And we thought Dennis was this a radical figure that didn't need to be on there. And the bottom line was he was just a great rebounder with a lot of personal problems, like everybody else probably in that series in some way. And so, you know, it's like we tried to make heroes and villains out of the Bulls. And the Bulls were really – people forget this. The Bulls were the villains in America at that time. Outside of Chicago – and outside of Ahmad and Michael Wilbon and Jay Adani and some other people that had personal relationships with some of that, the Bulls were not a liked franchise. They were they were very much the empire. They were the First Order, man. And the Jazz were like the little team that could. They were chugging up that hill, and they had Stockton and Malone. Remember Hot Rod Henley? Stockton and Malone, 45, 42, Jazz. I mean, they were the little small market that could. And so most of the national media was rooting for the Jazz in both those finals. The Bulls had just become so big. But all said and done, they did it. They did it, and they pulled it off. And, God, what can you say? I mean, it's just amazing. Well, you know, another thing. I am not, yeah. Unless somebody fesses up from a pizza parlor in Salt Lake City or a delivery guy says, yeah, it was me. I food. Like, well, the inference that Michael Jordan was purposely food poisoned by somebody in Chicago, by somebody in Salt Lake City, you're going to only say, oh, there were five guys that came to deliver the pizza. Okay. Well, if they knew it was going to Michael Jordan's house, why wouldn't there be five guys? You know, they were, you know, who? And they never told me what the pizza was. Did it have anchovies on it? Huh? I could see that. Did it have a supreme with sausage that was bad? You know, or like, come on. You know, what if it was just pizza?
Utah was and probably remains one of the most inhospitable visiting cities for any opponent to come in. I mean, those fans are brutal. And I was at both of those finals, as were you. Yeah. And I remember the house, you know, the three loudest or the two loudest arenas that I ever can remember being in were Seattle in the 1996 finals, the Key Arena, and the Delta Center then. It was brutal. And, you know, even his kids and those rare sound bites that we heard from his kids, it was like, yeah, I don't think our folks wanted us to be in Utah, because you know what those fans used to yell right. at players and still do. So, I mean, kids back then.
There was some not covert racism. There's probably some overt racism that directed at other that never came out. But those are also great basketball fans. I will say this. Seattle, I agree with you. Seattle, Utah, the Delta Center, which I used to call the Decibel Center, and and the Arco Arena in Sacramento, when the Kings were hot and they had right after Jason Williams, Mike Bibby, Chris Webber, Stojakovic, Vlade Divac, boy, they had one of the fun passing teams of all time. In fact, they were the Warriors before the Warriors, except they didn't play any defense. They didn't play enough defense like the Warriors did, but they were fun to watch. That Sacramento crowd was incredible. I mean, it was just so loud. I've heard the Oklahoma City crowd is somewhat like that, especially when Durant and Westbrook were going. But I don't know if there's anything like it. I do remember Indiana was a pretty tough place. They showed the woman do you remember her? She would
I don't
sit
remember
behind the
her,
bench.
But you could.
She was awful. When the Knicks came to town.
Her lips.
When the Knicks came to town, she would say stuff like, she'd say, like, hey, Starks, hey, Sacco boy. Like, oh, boy, it was just brutal. She would just
nasty. Kroger or somewhere, right? He used to bag groceries, so that's what she was referring to, right?
She probably met him there. I don't know. But that place was really tough to play. Yeah, I really thought that the Bulls don't win that series if they don't win game six, because Pippen's back did go out. It was just the whole thing was good. It was, it was a nice respite. And it kind of gave us some sports to get into. I still think down deep, knowing what we do now, knowing what we did before, but even what we do now more, that Michael Jordan, the competitor, He's wishing so badly that this coronavirus never happened. In fact, he's probably got an issue with the coronavirus now. And I don't like that, because the coronavirus could be hurt soon. I think maybe we could get rid of COVID-19 with Michael, because Michael Jordan was going to go head-to-head against LeBron James. Think about that. LeBron James in the NBA Finals, if the Lakers made it, Clippers could have been there. But either way, you could have said that would have even been more devastating for LeBron, because he would have had to watch Michael on the nights that he wasn't in the NBA Finals and realize, oh, my gosh, the GOAT conversation is all, you know, up and back. So I don't know. I think that would have been his ultimate But, you know, it's fun to see Jordan unplugged.
And hey, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say people forget how great he was remember only LeBron and some of the players of today as the players they remember. And Michael Jordan was a special, special human being as an athlete, as a competitor. It just was incredible. It was fun to watch. And it was,
And now that he's an owner, I remember when the last labor dispute came up and Jordan had just taken over owning the Charlotte team. One of the players or somebody said, well, Michael's on the negotiating team, that's good for us. And I'm thinking, you guys are tripping. Michael Jordan's not going to give you any inch. He's not one of you anymore, if he ever even was. He's on management side, and he is going to rip your heart out if he possibly can. So I don't know what they were thinking. I gotta tell our listeners something about you because Michael Jordan lit up the victory cigar, and I'm hoping that there's going to be a victory cigar for Mike Wise coming up soon, because I want to let our listeners know Mike has been nominated for an Emmy Award in the Capitol Emmys for his piece Survived By, 1 year after the Capitol Gazette shooting, a tragic, tragic episode, but one that you did an amazing 30-minute show on that you produced and also reported. And I remember when you sent me the clip last year when it first came out, my first response to you was, start writing that Emmy speech now because you're going to be delivering it. And now you're nominated officially. I believe you have some competition in that category, but you are going to win. I don't want to jinx you, but I just want all of our listeners to know that besides being, one of our stars at Pure Hoops Media, you are just getting it done across all media. So congratulations on the nomination. I hope you get the statue and, bravo, Mike.
That's nice of you to say, Bruce. And I did not expect that or see that coming from you. If you would not have said anything, I would have been hurt, and you really would have been on my bad side. And these things, as you know, these things cannot be done by one person. I'd like to thank – no, actually, I don't want to thank anybody. I stepped over a lot of people to get where I am, and I'm going to take the credit that I deserve. No.
You should thank Andrea Chambly, I think, should be on the show.
Here's the real truth about it. It was one of the most emotionally wrenching stories I'd ever done. And it came to be only because Andrea Chambly, who's on a guest of Pure Hoops Media, because she essentially finished her husband's book. It was her last love letter to John McNamara, whom I knew a little bit as a sports writer. And she wrote this book, The Capitol Basketball. And she gave me all this time, and it's something when someone lets their guard down and trust you to tell their story. I'm sure Jason Hare felt this way with the Bulls and some of the things that Michael told them. But it's like, this was a woman who lost her husband in a mass shooting, and she helped convince a couple other people, Maria Hyacin, whose husband Rob was shot and killed that day, and Summer Lee Geimer, she essentially, her mother was killed in the mass shooting. She's like a 20-something-year-old kid. These three women sat down with us, interviewed with us, gave us some of the most wrenching one-on-one interviews of all time. And, I'll be honest, they're not going to hear this, but if I can get my station to do it, if we win this thing, I'm just going to give them the Emmy. I really am. I'm going to give them the Emmy, and they can split it. And then on the side, when no one's looking, I'm going to buy my own, so I get a statue too. So I'll look like I'm really like being altruistic, but down deep, I'm getting a freaking gold statue, people. But anyway, no, thank you.
Everybody gets a statue at the Emmys, Mike.
Everybody gets a statue. All right. So it was very humbling, very cool, and I appreciate you bringing it up. I think we got to get to Sam Smith. He was awesome, right?
Sam Smith was awesome. Sam Smith is a Hall of Famer, and we really appreciated him spending some time with you on Sunday.
Sam Smith of Bulls.com has been a longtime follower of Michael Jordan and his dynasty. Sam was at the Chicago Tribune for 28 years. and has written books about the Bulls, including the Jordan Rules, and he hasn't stopped. He's made the transition from newsprint to digital media and adapted seamlessly from the past to the future. And did I mention that he won the Kurt Gowdy Media Award from the Basketball Hall of Fame in 2012? Hi, Sam.
Mike, good to hear you again. Haven't seen you in a while, but I heard your hair has grown back.
Yeah, it's amazing. The chia pet stuff you gave me is incredible. Thank you so much.
I got to tell you, I got to interrupt that because that's part of Jordan's greatness and what it separates him and makes him the greatest with all this debate all the time is that before Michael Jordan, men did everything possible to cover up being bald. Now you can have a shaved head and be proud of it, and that's because of Michael Jordan.
That's a great point. You know, that I forgot about that because as big a sort of cultural icon as he is in sports and whatnot, it's a great point because I remember we used to have jokes before that. It was sort of like, who did King Kong use as a roll-on? And it'd be like Telly Savalas, you know, or Yul Brynner. But after Michael, bald became cool. I remember, in fact, running into Charles Barkley, of all people, at like, you know, a finals in the late 90s. And he says to me, he goes, what are you doing? I go, what do you mean, what am I doing? He goes, what are you doing trying to act like you have hair? Take it back to God. Take it back to God. And he meant go bald. And of all people, of course, I listened to Charles Barkley, and that's when I went bald.
He's the voice of American basketball in a lot of respects. But actually, to give myself a brief plug, which I don't often do, but
yes.
I finished my non-Homeric trilogy of Jordan books about 5 or 6 years ago. I wrote a book called There Is No Next. And that was sort of the thesis of it, is that there was no next, not because, you know, you can have statistical accomplishments and, you know, LeBron's got this incredible longevity, but nobody is going to impact the society the way Jordan did. And part of it was timing when he came along, the sort of the financial birth of the NBA in effect with the salary cap and everything and, you know, TV contracts and everything. But, you know, the shaved head and the sneakers and the men wearing earrings and exporting the game to Asia and beyond where people had never heard of anything. And, you know, I remember David Stern always talked about his first trips to China and saying they would ask about the red oxen, which is a word for bulls. They didn't know anything else. Never heard of anybody else.
The
red oxen because of Jordan. So that's that incredible influence that he's had that really transcends the game and is responsible for you, Mike, having a happy life.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, how people of your ilk, like the Peter Vesey's, Mark Heisler's, Harvey Arredin's, people who actually were either given a beat or became such a national figure covering the NBA when people, you know, sports editors weren't making the NBA back in the 70s a league beat. It became a league beat for a lot of people. And one of them was me at the New York Times. And it did change my life because, shoot, I became acquainted with Shaquille O'Neal, wrote his autobiography for him. And, you know, all of a sudden these financial things come into play. It's a weird thing because, and Sam, one of the things I really like about The Last Dance, when we get to it, is the whole notion of not just people seeing, and I know you like this too, people seeing Michael Jordan for the first time, especially the millennial in anybody's household, is sort of, you know, they've not been brainwashed, but they just never saw anything before LeBron James or Kevin Durant or Dwayne Wade. And now all of a sudden they're being exposed to this incredible, easily the most individual, greatest player that I ever covered in any sport. I think that's great. I also think it's great that people like Sam Smith are getting acknowledged again for being as seminal to the game as they were. And so I think that part of it's cool. Just seeing you guys in the documentary talking about Michael and living in the moment.
Well, that's completely unnecessary, that part. And I'm sure it's hurt their ratings. As I told people, I've been at the same spot, unfortunately. You know, I'm grateful of that. And the circus basically just came back to my door again. So I just happened to be at the right place at the right time, which is what covering the, you know, Jordan and the Bulls were when I was, you know, I started at the Chicago Tribune in 1979. And was literally with Jordan his first week in Chicago. It was another, hey, here's the newest, latest top 10 draft pick rookie. We got a bunch of them. Orlando Ulbridge and Sidney Green, Ronnie Lester, the Bulls, Reggie Theus. The Bulls had all top 10 picks for about 7 or 8 years. And we would come in and do the boilerplate, you know, rookie's first week in town. So I was up to see Michael at his townhouse apartment in the north suburbs. You probably remember the Virgo Center. Walked in. He had his ironing board out. I said, you know, this is kind of a con. You're just trying to get me some color for the feature. No. He said, I ironed my clothes. He said, you know, I got the big ears, and I never had many dates in high school. I never thought I'd get married, so I took home economics courses. You know, I said, I'm also sewing some stuff, too. I said, well, I'll bring some stuff over. But, you know, with the documentary, what a great part, and it's a brilliant, Jordan's marketing, it probably will be studied in business schools for generations between his introduction in the 80s with Nike and the Spike Lee commercials and the Be Like Mike and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's this tremendous reintroduction of Jordan, you know, to a whole generation of people. You know, it's sort of like, I wasn't there for all the time, but like if you were in the 19th century, you heard about presidents, but you never saw them because there was, you know, so little communications, you know, people never traveled much, couldn't get anywhere. And now, you know, and so it's sort of like that. All this generation has heard about this guy, but he's been this recluse basically since he left Washington in 2003. You know, when the NBA brings out people, Bill Russell, you can see he's in bad medical shape, yet he, you know, he's been at finals and events, All-Stars and Elgin and Jerry West, of course, is still working, Oscar. You never see Jordan. He's the only one that never was at anything. And now, you not only you get him in what we, you know, how we knew him in the 80s, like this joking, funny, outgoing, challenging, competitive, last word personality you're seeing in these interviews, you know, with sort of the fun-loving twinkle in his eye thing. So, and then plus the clips of all the, you know, these great eras of the 80s and 90s. So it's this incredible reintroduction of this transcendent figure that's really, you know, in a lot of ways, the great appeal of this documentary.
Yeah, I agree. And I remember Bob Costas and some others talking once about the ABA, the old ABA, and how it was almost better because there was not that many news clips or TV clips of it, that it was almost better theater of the mind. You could actually imagine what Connie Hawkins did. I almost feel like Jordan was theater of the mind for many years, and now the video is even better, which is incredible. I was there, obviously, the night that they won it against the Jazz. I came on to the NBA beat and the Knicks, Jordan had already won 3 and he'd stepped away. And I remember I was covering the Nets for a year, and then I went and covered the Knicks. And then all of a sudden Jordan came back that year, and it was just, but the thing about it is I remember you weren't the bitter, jaded guy, but there were a lot of people in that sort of bull circle at that point that were just, God, the Bulls became such a circus at that point. They were the Beatles that second time around in some ways. And I remember thinking, John, Mike and David Falk and everybody just felt so imperious. They were just pains in the asses to me. And while I liked covering them down deep, I kind of wanted to see them get beat because I just got tired of the egos, tired of how important they thought they were. And sure enough, they justified it all. Where do you come down on the whole thing? Because at some point they made your life miserable.
That's your New Yorker, you know, in you. Even though I'm a native New Yorker, I escaped and realized there's great depth in humanity in a lot of respects to the world other than the New York cynical view of mankind, which is often justified. I agree and understand. And you're right. You said earlier that there's tremendous myth making about Jordan, understandably so, because we in America, really more than anywhere, seems to me, we celebrate the ultimate success. Either you're a winner and everybody else is tied for last place. Like the Buffalo Bills at the Super Bowl. Jimmy's great. I followed actually a lot of the AFL back then, and actually the ABA. I remember going to games in Teaneck, New Jersey to see the Mets, Commack, Long Island. And then there were some awful games and awful teams, and so there was myth as well to the ABA too. But we build that up, and so Jordan was sort of the ultimate hero of that, is that the American ethic is to support the winner no matter what, no matter how he behaves or however he got there, the end justifies the means kind of thing. And so in our case, of course, living in Chicago, it's sort of different. Chicago didn't have a great history of successful sports teams, not like New York with the Yankees and dynasties, Boston or LA, any of that thing. So it's a big city, and that sort of that second city insecurity complex sort of hovered over Chicago, which I kind of could see from afar, and then being up close, having come from New York. And so it was a rare thing that you could embrace. This was the rare time that Chicago had. Because even in other sports, they're great figures, Ernie Banks in baseball, whatever, or even, Gale Sayers and Dick Butkus were like tragic figures. You got hurt or played with losing teams. And so here was this, for the first time, Chicago could really have, we had the number one guy. And so it was this incredible source of civic pride. And then it was the most unusual and spectacular championship team ever. There'd never been anything like it. There never will be anything like it. There hasn't been anything like it. Because you've got the greatest player in Jordan, or the way, okay, you want to argue it, whatever. You could take this one or that one. But then you've also got this unique coach with 11 titles, with this unusual way of going about it, even though Phil was really excellent with X's and O's to the point. Red Holtzman hadn't sat on the bench as his unofficial assistant in 69-70 when Phil missed that season with back surgery. So Phil knows here, but also with the Zen and the Native American symbolism and all that stuff. So you have that. And so over the time when you showed up, now Rodman is a part of it. So you've got this most bizarre feature who's acting out. And this incredible undefeated team that's never losing. Once he got there, he won every time. Nobody did that, basically. Even Russell, with all those great championships, the one year Sixers finally got past him, had to win like every game of the season, to do it. You have this incredible team in 67. And, LeBron's lost, the Warriors lost, Spurs could never repeat, Lakers couldn't get three, Celtics couldn't get three. So nobody has done, and this guy gets three twice in a row. So you have this extraordinary circumstance of these individuals. And so it grew to such proportions. And the other element, like you mentioned, which is a good point, there becomes some resentment because, and I didn't particularly feel it. I loved it. It was sort of my dream job, being involved, being able to do that. Growing up, I always admired the New York. Delivered the papers when I was a kid, the Daily News, the Mirror, World Telegram, and loved the newspaper columnists. I never imagined I'd have an opportunity to do something like that. So it was always sort of a lifelong thrill to me. But when you're there at the beginning and no one's there, which we were in the 80s, the narrative was you can't win with Jordan. Jordan, Bird wins, Magic wins, that's how you win. You don't win by scoring. And so... we're there traveling by ourselves all through the 80s with this great figure and this losing team. Jordan loses 9 of the first 10 playoff games he played in, essentially Jerry Krause is rebuilding the team under him. So, I think you probably are seeing some of that resentment of like, hey, we were here at the beginning. What are you guys doing here now? Because you think you own this thing, but it was us.
Yeah. Look, the one thing I got from this right off the bat, it must have been episode 3 or 4, was I forgot how much Jordan paid his dues. Not just the Pistons, but the losing, the joining a team that just was awful in the beginning. And, you know, when you think of Magic winning a championship his first year, joining Kareem and Norm Nixon, a very good crew, and you think of Bird winning in his second year and winning three of four, and, you know, just you think of their success early. They went to very good organizations and teams, and the Bulls weren't anything, and Michael turned them into something. And I forget all that. It was so fun to watch the early winning. But I want to get to this because I thought if you're just a basketball fan and you don't know who Stan Smith is, you just get the hell off this podcast because he's one of the most authoritative, smart guys in the history of covering the game. Two, just Google Sam Smith and Bulls.com. I really enjoyed Ask Sam Mailbag recently. I love this guy basically saying he wanted the alternate perspective from Sam Smith. And he writes, if you lived and grew up in Chicago, fine, enjoy. But we're talking the entire free world loved Michael. I wanted no part of it. When the championship started, there was no end to the suffocating Jordan worship. Pretty easy to get behind a winner after they started winning. He was more like Michael Jackson than Magic Johnson. If you followed the NBA, you had to suck it up. And he goes into this whole thing and he wants to know what it, and you reply, I'm not sure you are allowed to feel that way and remain in the United States, certainly not Chicago. I'm not going to report you, but this is your last warning. And you get into a very thoughtful answer to him, basically saying that this guy was more than just a great basketball player, that he represented many things to Chicago. He became the blueprint for especially the African-American athlete and how to market yourself. I mean, hell, for whatever you can say about how bad some of his Charlotte teams have been, he's an owner. There's nobody who ever played that was a person of color that owned it, that went back into ownership, and certainly Michael Jordan did it. Was there any part of you that went, okay, I'm done with Michael and his act, or are you still, you know, hey, this was a great point. This is a great part of my life. My life wouldn't have been the same without Michael Jordan and what happened with that team. And I have to, in hindsight, look at all the good things rather than anything that might have annoyed me.
Well, personally, I always had great appreciation for Bulls and Jordan, and always say, anybody who have had success, if they're honest with themselves, realizes that it's more about good fortune and good luck and being in the right place at the right time. You know, if I had written the version of the Jordan rules about the Sacramento Kings, I'm sure I wouldn't be on your podcast. So circumstances.
That's not true. I love the Kings. My sister lives in Sacramento, but you're right.
All right. Well, why don't you call one of their beat writers next time and
get their Chris Webber losing in the seventh game of the
finals. Right, exactly. Chris Webber now wanting the last shot for a change.
It was
just great fun. I mean, it was a great. It's wearying, and it's wearying on Jordan too, and that's why, you know, he left when he did in 92-93. Obviously, more factors with his father's murder. And left when he was in 97-98. I'm interested, you know, in some respects, I was interested with the documentary, how they were going to portray that, because it's The Last Dance, you know, and the theme is the Bulls, you know, management broke him up or something. But, yeah, he was done. You know, you saw in a lot of the earlier episodes with him talking with Ahmad, who he's obviously closest with, saying, you know, I got to move on with my life. I'm worn out. And, you know, what was happening with Pippen and his estrangement with the team, Rodman and his estrangement with reality. And so he knew, you know, he knew full well that he was going to drag it down to the end. And you know, appropriately enough, as it came down, he really was alone at the end. You know, Pippen back went out.
Yes.
He got to play 45 minutes in that last game. He basically, and that's one of the great sequences to me in the history of the game, that last minute of game six, where he makes basically everything Michael Jordan was over 13 years was displayed in 1 minute of basketball.
Well, because if nobody And you just said that, Sam. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just got through reading your take on that, the last minute. It was one of the best things you ever wrote about the Bulls, because that, you're right, that minute was a metaphor for the greatness of him and that franchise in ways you can't even – I mean, even the play to go straight to the basket and get a quick two, people don't even think about that now. But I remember me and Isola looking at each other going, that was the worst thing that could have happened for the Jazz. They didn't even have to work for that shot.
Right. Gave him too much time.
And yeah.
Then, you know, offense, defense, intelligence, not calling a timeout, realizing where Carl's not going to see the double coming off from the baseline instead of over the top. I mean, there were so many elements of just that one, and basically did it himself. Nobody else touched the ball. Nobody else made a play.
Yeah.
I mean, it was only a minute, but like you said, it was just a wonderful metaphor summary of everything this guy was and how special he was. No player essentially does those kind of things. So even though, you know, when you go through, when you're there, you don't think of things as history. You know, I make the example sometimes, and I wasn't at the Gettysburg Address, but I know of it. And I'm sure the people who were there are not thinking, well, you know, 150 years from now, people will be talking about, you know, these words and these hallowed ground. And they're thinking, man, it's cold. Finish up, Abe. Let's get out of here. And so, you know, when you're covering a team through the championships and going through those playoffs, as exhilarating as it is, you know, you're just sort of, you know, following the elephants out of town. You know,
yeah. Oh no, you're right.
You're stepping around all the stuff. You know, you're not.
Yeah.
And while it's exhilarating and exciting, it's also wearying. So it was an amazing run. But you know, from being a beat writer, your thought is, hey, what's the next story? What time's deadline? So I have to have an update to follow. You know, so you're just following it through, and you don't really have time to reflect on it that much.
Yeah, but you kind of, I felt like it anyway, especially at the end where I was like, this is, you're in the presence of something. I just remember, like, because the New York Times had such tight deadlines then that and we were pretty much writing for the Guam edition, and we would literally write switch leads, and you know, if one team won or the other won. And I can't tell you how many times I just started it with Michael Jordan did this and did that. And the guy on the desk, God bless him, Carl Nelson, would just go, ah, this works, because it was Michael Jordan. It was like a video game. It was just, you press the button, it was going to happen. And it's still surreal to me. I mean, I remember when he hit that shot, it wasn't like the Delta Center went quiet. It was like the whole state went quiet. It was like a funeral. And it was like, that's the power of what Jordan could do. That's what he did. I mean, I'll give you the greatest. Wilbon will never cop to this, but it's a great moment. I'm sitting next to Wilbon at the time, and Frank Isola's on the other side, and we're looking, and Wilbon looks at me. Michael's missed like four or five shots in a row at the end, and he goes, look, Pippen's back's out. They're losing game seven. He goes, and they're, I don't know what they were down, five or seven, and he goes, it was like about 3 minutes left. He goes, I'm out of here. This guy, he's done. Jordan's done. And he walked away. And I'm like, Jordan's done. You're my Wilbon. You're his guy. You can't say that. And sure enough, I ran into him in the press,
the press room after. Mike,
and he goes,
you know,
I can't believe it. What's that?
The great thing about Mike, he's such a beloved, such a wonderful guy, is that he really, and that's why I think he's so successful and so popular in what he does, is he's more like a fan than a media guy. Because media guys tend to be a little more cynical about things. And I've seen this before. Let's sit it out. You know, and Mike reacts emotionally to so much that he sees things in the moment. And so in the moment, he was let down, as much as he'd be over exhilarated when they win and, you know, be like a fan celebrating, probably jumping up at the scorer's table. He cheers in the press box. So he's a little different than everybody
else. No, you're definitely right. We would look at each other if something happened, but I just remember thinking to myself, this is not happening like it was. And I'm of the opinion, I'm sure you were too, because, you know, we've seen 9 and 10 now, that I don't think they would, this is just me, I don't think they win game seven in Utah. I think the narrative is a lot different. Maybe we still get this documentary, but we certainly don't get the happy Michael ending. because I think if he does, if that doesn't happen, I do not think they win game seven. Your thoughts?
Well, right. We always, you know, consider those circumstances and always give the disclaimer, except it's Michael Jordan, because, you know, he pulled off these events so many times, you know, like the shot, it's sort of almost a bookend, the shot in Utah, going back to the shot in Cleveland, where, you know, I mean, the trajectory of the Bulls would have changed so dramatically had they lost that series, because, which they should have. They were not favored. They'd been swept by the Cavs that season. Oh, they were 0-6. Jordan had missed the crucial free throws at the end of game four, which would have won the series. And now they had to go back to Cleveland for game five. And that was a series where they end up upsetting the Knicks in the next round, who had a better record with Patino, 52 wins, and then taking a 2-1 lead on the Pistons in the conference finals. You know, and getting this incredible credibility, which wouldn't have been there had they lost in the first round, and maybe start breaking up the team again.
And so, yes.
And you never say never with Jordan. But that said, right, Pippen probably wouldn't have been able to play. And if you look back at that last game, Tony Kukoc was the only other player on the team who scored in double figures.
Yeah.
There was virtually, you know, no offense left. And you're in Utah for game seven and all that kind of stuff. But that's also why I've always maintained, you know, this notion, and I know they had to play it up in the documentary that, you know, the Bulls were forced out and they would have won, you know, another title in 98-99, which, you know, in some respects you could say Jerry Krause saved Jordan's legacy. Not that it wouldn't have been a great legacy.
But you know what?
If he comes back in 98-99 and doesn't even make the playoffs because, you know, Pippen is out and Rodman has gone nuts and, you know, a lot of guys have left, you know, and so how would it look then? I mean, it was the most fitting, perfect ending the way it was.
You know what? Can we steal like a couple more minutes of your time just because I want to talk to you about
sure.
that? Oh, that's great. Okay.
You know, there's a pandemic going on, so I'm not really going anywhere.
I'm kind of like my kids. I was going to make a COVID joke, but I'm not going to. It just would be bad for business. But here's the thing. By the way, Sam and I have something in common that he doesn't even know we have in common. We even though he's a little older than I am, our favorite player of all time is Willie Mays, who just turned 89. And I ended up like enjoying the Say Hey Kid when he came to San Francisco because my grandfather was a big Giants fan and was always angry that they were losing. And Mays came and changed everything. And he was so fun to watch. And yeah, he was just, you know, it was even when I started covering sidebar games for the Sacramento Union back in the day with Don Drysdale, not the pitcher, but the beat writer for the Sacramento Union. He basically... Yeah. I would be in the lock. I'd be in the Giants clubhouse, and I would almost be. I would be getting nervous just to go up and say hi to Willie Mays as he sat there as a community relations guy. It was just incredible. I look at your career and I just think, God, what if Sam was a really good business reporter? You would have never been an NBA guy. It's almost like you had to not be good at that to become the success you became. I mean, there's a great moral to the story in just your career.
You know, there's a thing that Michael Jordan always said. They did it in one commercial, and it's true. He said, and to me, it's one of the points that make that another point that separates him. I don't mean to pick on LeBron. I have great respect for LeBron, and he is one of the great players, but. You know, he's afraid to fail. He was, you know, he doesn't get in the contest, you know, dunk and the 3-point. He he's more human than Michael. He worries about what people think. Michael didn't, you know, and Michael said in that one of the commercials, but I know he said it many times because he did have these failures, spectacular failures where he would miss shots or things would happen or lose games. And he said, you know, the reason I succeed is because I failed so many times.
Yeah.
And that is the great lesson. You know, for anybody in life, you know, and guys in sports, all the great players. I know Bill Walton. Well, Bill's a good friend, and we talked about a lot of stuff. And you could never get Bill to talk about 88 wins in a row at you know, at UCLA and all the great accomplishments. He remembers in vivid detail the loss, every loss, you know, when they lost the game after the streak and all these things. And I found that characteristic in the great, great players, that they remember defeat and they remember failing because they never expected to. And it was so shocking to them. And that was always a lesson. That was always something that I thought was special and admired about Jordan, that, you know, that he challenged himself constantly. He was willing to lose, understood losing, but nothing drove him more. And, you know, he had so much of that early in his career that when he finally got there, that's why he competed at that level. And so you say, well, would they have lost game seven? Well, they should have. But maybe not with Michael Jordan in the picture, you know, because he was able to accomplish these incredible things under these difficult circumstances.
All right, real quick lightning round with Sam Smith of Bulls.com, who essentially is—I don't want to say he's a mentor, but someone definitely. When I got into the league, I looked up to him and many others, how they covered the beat, how they tried to maintain relationships with players, but also had a healthy distance. So if they had to write something critical, they could. It really, I love what you said about Jerry Krause. Real quickly, did Jerry Krause get a fair shake in this documentary? I like Jerry. I know he was socially, he probably had some social, social anxiety disorder.
Inept was the word you're looking for.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, fair is, you know, a personal view, judgmental. I feel he was depicted accurately. Jerry was very difficult to live with. In this modern NBA, he would be the executive vice president of basketball operations, and you wouldn't see him. He'd be making decisions behind the scenes, scouting. You know, essentially, Jerry was a rumpled scout. He was, but in that NBA of the mid 80s, there wasn't the economics to have a big front office. And so the scout had also become the so-called face of the franchise. And, you know, whatever the psychological issues would be about the unpopular kid growing up, wanting to be one of the guys, whatever, without getting into that, Jerry was difficult to live with, difficult to be around. But at the same time, if your antagonist, or the protagonist of the story, but the antagonist for Jerry is Michael Jordan, and you've got no sense of humor, you can deal with Michael. Michael was great fun to deal with, but you had to be on your guard, and you needed to be sharp, because he was coming at you verbally as much, and Jerry could not deal with that. You know, he couldn't respond because he was kind of humorless, but at the same time, he's the boss, so you know, I'm in charge. You know, you don't win with Michael Jordan pulling that one. And so difficult, but on the other hand, it was fair because Jerry was executive of the year twice, voted by his peers, which is not, which was among elite. Not many executives have gotten that. He was the chief executive of the franchise that won six championships. So there was no reason to fire him. Yeah, your employees don't like you. You know what? I didn't like most of the sports editors I worked for. It didn't mean they should be fired. It's whatever. They did their job. I did my job. And it's not supposed to affect you. And so the team succeeded. So, you know, Jerry's, you know, the issue with the public probably was displayed most with the players in that one scene when I come back from Detroit and he's dancing the aisle with the players. Get out of there. That's not where you're supposed to be. And so, you know, who you know, has a celebration at work and invites the boss? it's just not the way it works. And so if Jerry had stayed in the background, like the owner, like, you know, whoever else, like basically the GM of every other team, he wouldn't have been probably depicted the way he was. But, you know what? It's like a great novel, and every great novel, you know, needs a villain. You know,
I just wish you were... I just wish you were alive to say, you know, like, or his wife could get up there and say something. I mean, because I think Jordan loved to dish it out. I don't know if he could take it. I could see if he joked with Jerry Krause about his weight and his height. I'd love to see how Jordan looked up when Jerry said, you know, hey, Hey, how's Rich Esquinas doing these days, Michael? How's he doing? You talked to him lately?
Yeah, but see, Mike, that was the point. Jerry couldn't do that. He had no sense of humor, and he wasn't glib, and he wasn't quick. So if Jerry were alive today, he couldn't defend himself. And if he would, he'd have made it worse, I guarantee you. Not that it's good he's passed away, you know. My guess would be if he were alive today, he would probably say nothing. People would advise him to keep quiet about it, so you're going to make it worse. And if Jerry had been able to respond in a snarky way like you just did, then it wouldn't have been the way it was. Michael would have, like, you know, with Steve Kerr with the fight or whatever. Once you go back at Michael, then he gained some respect for you. Jerry never knew or understood how to do that.
That's very good insight. I believe Brian Russell would have been called for pushing off had it been the other way around in game six. Do you believe Michael Jordan pushed off?
No.
Sam, you're such a homer.
Well, you know what? That's what I don't get accused of very much after writing the Jordan rules. But it was incidental contact. You know, Jordan's a long arm guy. You know, look, on that move, Russell, first of all, he's a good defender. He's not a great defender. And Jordan is making a lightning quick, you know, stop on a dime move at you at a guy backpedaling. There's no way he was going to be able to stop and maintain position in front of him like that. And Jordan's arm, you know, to me, just sort of made incidental contact with his hip. It wasn't like in his chest or something. It was, you know, on his butt or on his hip. It was on the side. So, you know, that's as Jordan would have said and always has said, and America says, you know, that's the lament of losers.
Yeah.
You know, if you look back, if you want to go back to something in this series, so Howard Eisley's three that was overturned.
It was a three, but they called it a two.
They called it no basket.
Oh, that's right.
2 points off the board. It was a three that they said came after the buzzer, which didn't. So in this
But
NBA,
you're right.
But, you know, that's well, different. That's,
yeah,
that's different
no, you're right.
Something that happens early in the game, you ought to be able to make up. You can't go back and say, well, you should have had 3 more points on the board.
Yeah.
Plus,
and
they were
lastly,
better than the Jazz.
What's that?
Plus, they were better than the Jazz.
Yeah, they were better than the Jazz. And it's funny, too, how remember Fran Blindberry, a beat writer we both know for many years in Houston.
Yeah, Fran's great friend, yeah.
Fran's great friend. And I remember him, gosh, it must have been game six in Chicago the first year. And he goes, he said, if Rodman makes these 2 free throws, there's no God. And it was essentially a game in which they needed him to win and win that championship that year. And he made them both. And I said to Fran, we try to put morals on these stories, and like Rodman's not a worse human being than this. And he's like, oh no, he's not like Karl Malone. I'm like, well, look at the things we learned about Karl Malone later. That he fathered a teenager, there was a young teenager that he fathered a girl with.
My
point is, these guys are like, we don't know who's good and bad. They're all flawed, and why judge them, and why not just appreciate what they were as players at some point?
Actually, that was my message with the Jordan rules. But more than that, it was Charles Barkley's message of that era.
You know,
all the criticism Michael's gotten about my fault in part because of the Republicans' vice sneakers to comment, which was a joke, which is the last word quip of his.
That
got twisted around to other people's interest to make it a political philosophy. Barkley in that era was most famous, and that was an ethic of all the players, is that we're not your role models. You know, get role models in a place where it's appropriate, in your school, your parents, your home, whatever. Don't look at us as your role models. And you know, that was sort of the lesson that the players were universally talking about. You know, in the 80s into the 90s, you know, so, you know, it's equally the same. And that's what it is with actors, actresses, politicians, whatever. You know, don't live your lives through them because they're essentially entertainers.
This has been great, Sam. And you've been great. Thank you for the extra time. And I could talk to you about this all day, all the side stories and whatnot. We were fortunate enough to have David Stern in his last interview I look back on it, I can't believe he passed that soon after. Yeah. But we asked him about the whole gambling thing, and he was very much like, yeah, apparently Michael was in my living room the night before, that was a report somewhere. And I said, he said, are you crazy? You think we would want to lose Michael Jordan? I'm of the opinion still, and you might completely disagree. I'm of the opinion still that while the league wasn't going to suspend him, there was some real serious conversation going on between both sides. And at some point, Michael just got sick of it and said, screw you guys. You're going to mess with me? I'm going to walk away. I'm going to do my own thing. I have personal problems. That's my own. I'll never be able to prove it, of course. And it's such a...
I'll finish it up there for you, Mike. And I appreciate it. It was good to talk to you, and you said very, very nice things about me. I appreciate that. And always appreciate seeing you. When the gambling stuff really originally started, it was with this Slim Buller character when Jordan didn't go to the White House in 1991. He went on this gambling weekend. I mean, imagine the scandal level in this era that it might have been. He skips the trip to the White House. The rest of the team goes. He says he's going on a family vacation. He goes to a gambling weekend with Slim Buller, you know, sort of like, you know, playing pool with a guy named Lefty or something. Don't do that. So unbeknownst to him, you know, Slim is a convicted drug dealer. There was a bail bondsman who financed the weekend who got murdered. And they found Michael's check and his belongings. That's how it came out. You know, and then the other things developed with the, you know, Buddy Rich's Aquinas and going to Atlantic City between games, which was laughable. I don't know if you read the New York Times then, but that was the most amazingly immature, stupid thing the New York Times ever did, in Michael Jordan between games, condemning him for getting in at 2 a.m. And I remember one of the New York writers asking me about that, and I said, I'm shocked too, because he usually gets in at 5, and then he gets 50 points.
But Harvey wrote the column.
Let me. It was Dave Anderson.
Oh, you're right. Dave Anderson found out. That's right.
The nicest man in the world. They're just the wonderful, nicest man.
God rest his soul.
You know, sort of the opposite of every other New York writer in the city. Just a wonderful guy. And, you know, he was outraged about this. And anyway, which was, you know, because Michael, that's the way he lived his life. You know, he played cards at 5 in the morning. He played golf at 7, and then he got, you know, 52 points. And he did it, you know, playoff after playoff after playoff. And it's legendary stuff. But I'll just tell you quickly. So the Tribune, you know, this scandal comes out, Rich Aquinas, so all the gambling stuff. So we put together an investigative team and go down and to interview all these guys. Aquinas, when the gambling stuff breaks with the league, the league's going to do investigation. And we go to every single one of these guys involved, of course, other than a dead guy. And so we, our investigative guy, I wasn't part of that, but I'm covering the team still. And so, but he's a friend of mine. So I asked him, I got his notes afterwards, and we talked about it. So every time they went down and they would say, well, they do the interviews about what happened. And they say, well, what did the NBA investigator ask you? We didn't talk to anyone from the NBA. They did not talk, their investigation did not talk to a single person involved in that whole episode. They did not want, if there was anything wrong, and there really was nothing major, I don't believe, but if there was, the NBA did not want to hear it. They were not going to deal with getting their Michael Jordan, their biggest producer, out of the league. David Stern, the ultimate capitalist of sports, was not putting pressure on Michael Jordan. And what Michael was upset about, because he went to see Stern about this, and it was, David was sort of on the defensive. You know, he went back to the league office when they called him up that one time. So he comes up, and he only did it. I remember this vividly. He wasn't going to go see it out of his way to see it. He tells the league, I'll come see you when the team's in New York. I ain't coming otherwise. So we're in New York, and he goes up to see David, and he says that this whole thing is bull. You know, and after all I've done, after all every interview you have me on, all these, you know, shows, inside stuff, whatever they're called, I do all this junk for you guys, and this is the way you deal with me. So he was like furious with the league. Now, I wasn't quitting because of that, but he was basically saying, you guys lay off because, like, your point, but Michael's point is, I'm going to do what I want.
Michael
Jordan, I'm worried about the league. And David is like, well, yeah, no, we apologize. You know, David's like regretting this. He says, oh, no. And like I said, when the Tribune, when we went looking and had an investigative team that won Pulitzer doing this story, we couldn't find a single NBA investigator who talked to anybody involved with the story.
That's tremendous, because it tells you exactly what happened. Hey, this is great, Sam. I hope at some point when all this global pandemic stuff dies down a little bit, we can get some food or drink at some point.
All right, Mike, again, good to talk to you, and good luck with your project there.
Thank you, sir, and yours as well.
That was dope.
Thanks to Sam Smith of Bulls.com for sharing stories and insight from the Jordan years and The Last Dance. Thanks also to my producer, Bruce Bernstein, for whatever it is that he does. Thanks also to our editor, Ben Wolfen, for putting the audio puzzle together. Please check out all of our Pure Hoops Media shows. Each Tuesday, we have Full Court Press with Fanta and Adams, where they have college basketball covered. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Otto and Aaron has a new show every Wednesday. And Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with Monica McNutt is here each Thursday. Friday, well, you know, it's the Pure Hoops podcast with BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman. BJ was a member of the first three Bulls championship teams, and his MJ stories are gold. If you have enjoyed The Last Dance, all of our Pure Hoops Media shows over the last 5 weeks have been on that topic with a variety of amazing guests and voices like Will Perdue, BJ Armstrong, Charlie Rosen, David Aldridge, and this week's guest, Sam Smith. Go back and check them out. All the stories are fresh and the shows are free.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
Please continue to honor your fellow citizens by wearing your mask in public, washing your hands, and maintaining physical distancing when you venture outside. Treat everyone right because, look, we're all in this together. Pray for the safety of our healthcare professionals, other essential workers, and each other. And stay safe, everyone. We'll be back next week with another edition of The Mike Wise Show. Peace!
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.